Number 2. The mystery continues. Jacques was a cool character. He picked up a mug from the dirt and poured coffee from a flask in front of him and sipped it as he drank in the sight on the horizon. Jerry smiled and gently patted the weapon as if he was patting a dog which was pulling at the leash, wanting to attack its prey. When the light spread across the beach below them, they could see tens of thousands of German machine gunners as far as the eye could see, lying in the sand behind tufts of grass. As the Allied forces approached the shores, the horizon darkened as the skies filled with Allied air support. When the roar of the planes became louder, a German voice came over the radio that was lying in the soil of the bunker. It said,
"You have your orders. May God be with you."
That made Jerry fume. Suddenly, there was a massive boom of artillery as the 450mm guns behind them blazed against the Allies and signaled the machine gunners to open fire on the troops that were pouring onto the beach. Jerry immediately turned the gun to the left and discharged a mass of bullets into the bunker less than 60 feet from him. Then he lifted his sights, and he did the same with the one next to that. Then he swung the firearm towards the hordes of German soldiers that lay on the beach below him and rained bullets onto them as Pierre fed the hungry gun its fill of ammunition. The sight of so many Allied soldiers being hit by the torrent of German bullets was too much for Jacques. Masses of them were being killed before they even had a chance to reach the shore. Their dead and wounded bodies floated among the blood-crimson foam of the waves. These were men who were giving their lives to liberate France. With total disregard of the fact that he would be seen by rows of German artillery stationed about 100 feet back from the cliff edge, Jacques climbed out of the shelter of the bunker. He then ran across to the bunker containing two dead Germans and pushed their bodies aside. In the heat of battle, he picked up two machine guns and with one in each hand ran to the back of the third bunker of stunned Germans who didn't expect to be attacked from behind, filling them with lead. Then he hurled himself into it and began firing like a madman at everything that moved. It was a suicide mission. Predictably, there was a sudden and massive explosion right on top of the bunker into which Jacques had climbed as the Germans put an end to the life of this courageous Frenchman. Chapter 10. Liberation. London was in ruins. Hitler had terrorized the residents with his miracle weapon, the V-1. The pilotless, jet-propelled bomber carried over a ton of explosives and flew at a speed of 370 miles per hour. After one raid, Winston Churchill had the unenviable task of announcing to Parliament that the weapon had taken 2,752 British lives. The great statesman, confident that Germany would never conquer Britain, broadcast via the BBC to the French,
"We are waiting for the long-promised invasion. So are the fishes."
A short time after the V-1 attacks, despite a massive loss of life on the beachfront, the Allies drove back the Germans from the shores of Normandy and took out the launching pads for the V-1 rockets. The battles had raged from June 6 through June 27, and at times the German defense seemed almost invincible. They had stationed a row of 4 pillboxes which stopped the Allies in their tracks. Finally, at the end of June, soldiers were able to advance close enough to destroy them by tossing grenades through their ventilators. The two freedom fighters joined themselves to Allied forces and discovered a tunnel in the southern quarter of Cherbourg. When smoke from Nazi gunfire spewed out, the Americans decided that they would blast the tunnel open. Just as they decided to do that, a private emerged holding onto a white flag. He told one of the American commanders that General Karl von Schlieben was within the tunnel and wished to surrender. Jerry watched in delight as 800 soldiers emerged from the tunnel. A total of 30,000 German soldiers surrendered to the Allies at Cherbourg. Even as the Allies advanced across Europe, Hitler continued bombarding London using V-2 rockets. These carried the same amount of explosives as the V-1, but they were faster and deadlier. They traveled at the speed of sound, and it was almost impossible to detect their approach. Before taking his leave of France, Jerry decided to backtrack with the Allies to enjoy the sweetness of taking Paris back from the Germans. The liberation began on August 25, 1944, when General Charles de Gaulle led a tumultuous parade through the streets of Paris, and that night, church bells rang all over the city. Despite the devastation Jerry found in London, he liked being in England. The British made a Yank feel special. After the war ended, he decided he would try and recapture his lost youth. He was still in his 20s, and as far as he could see, he had two options. He could either return to Texas and join his mother on the farm, or he could begin a new life in England. He had reestablished contact with his mom, and she was doing fine. The friend his father left managing the farm had been able to get it on its feet financially, and it was drawing a healthy wage for both himself and Jerry's mom. So he decided that he would try living in England, and if it didn't work out, he would return to the U.S. After he had made his decision to stay, he applied for a job with a government construction company in London. There was no shortage of work as London had to be rebuilt. It was physically hard work, but the pay was good, and because he was single, he was able to save most of his paycheck. It wasn't long before he had his own car and had moved to a better apartment in Wembley on the outskirts of London. Friends at work would often encourage Jerry to join them and play darts at a local pub. It was at the pub that he met Connie, a quiet lass with a strong Yorkshire accent. One day, he noticed that she was watching his every move as he played darts with a friend, so he offered to buy her a drink. She accepted, and it wasn't long before they had established a friendship. Connie had been moved from London to the small town of Oatley at the outbreak of the war when she was 14 years old. Her parents sent her to live with an aunt for safekeeping. Both her parents were killed in the bombing raids, and their bodies were never recovered. The first time they sat together and ate fish and chips, he asked her about her past, and she wept openly as she spoke of her folks. There were a lot of tears in London. Jerry fell deeply in love with this soft-spoken young lady. He loved everything about her, including her strong accent. She was different from the confident girls he grew up with back home. She was very reserved, and because of the loss of her parents, he felt an empathy with her. When he put a comforting arm around her as she wept, it made him feel good. It uncovered a tenderness he had forgotten that he possessed. He loved the fact that she listened to him when he spoke, and he would often catch her staring at him for no reason as they ate lunch together. They were married in a small Anglican church not too far from Jerry's apartment. Chapter 11. A Faithful Friend. When Connie's aunt became ill with tuberculosis, they moved to Oatley to nurse her. 2 months later, she tragically died and left her cottage to Connie. They sold the property and with the proceeds, together with a bank loan, purchased a sheep farm just north of Oatley. Jerry loved the green countryside. Parts of it reminded him of France, especially around the Ordoie-sur-Glane district. The two of them would arise in the cool of each morning at 6 o'clock and begin the many duties around the farm. They had two sheepdogs that Jerry purchased to help round up the sheep. One of the dogs was a purebred border collie, which he named Faithful. The other was a cross he purchased very cheaply from the local pound. Both dogs were instinctive when it came to rounding up sheep, but Faithful was particularly intelligent. Jerry gave the animal that name because of the character of the breed, faithfulness. Connie and Jerry loved walking together to the barn and unleashing the dogs first thing in the morning. The animals would yelp with excitement, wag their tails, and almost choke themselves on their leashes as they pulled at the ropes that restrained them. As soon as they were off the leash, Faithful would run around in circles of delight at the prospect of getting onto the back of the truck. Both dogs would stand right on the edge of the flatbed and lean into the wind, their eyes scouring the horizon of the fields as though they had never seen the countryside before. Rarely did the Adamsons leave the farm. They saved every penny and purchased a small herd of milking cows, and the milking was a twice-daily happening. Even if one of them went into Oatley for supplies, it was never for more than half a day. In February of 1946, Connie returned from a routine visit to the doctor. Her face glowed as she drove the flatbed and parked it by the barn. Jerry came out of the barn holding a spade in his hand, and as he opened the truck door, he asked, "Well, what's the verdict?" She beamed from ear to ear and said,
"Doctor says there's a bun in the oven. You are going to be a father."
Sometime later, the bun was almost baked, and as Connie emerged from a checkup at the clinic, she met an old school friend. During that time, she'd had a crush on him and even dated him once or twice. But in just 10 years, he had changed. He had lost a little hair, and working for the local newspaper at a desk job, coupled with good home baking, had given him a pot belly. Connie smiled as she thought that she must look the same to him, but her belly wasn't the result of lack of exercise. As they stood by her truck, he quizzed her on what she had been doing since the war. It took about 10 minutes to fill him in on her new life, and when she let slip that Jerry was with the French Resistance for 4 years, he raised his eyebrows and said, "I would love to do a story about you two. Nothing sensational, just a local human interest story. What do you say?" Connie knew that Jerry didn't like to boast about the war, so she smiled and said she would talk it over with him, and they agreed that he would phone her the next day. 2 weeks later, a half-page article appeared in the local newspaper. Jerry had agreed to do the story as long as the reporter put emphasis on the fact that he was an American who had married a local girl and not on the war. If any mention was made that he was a freedom fighter for the resistance, he didn't want it to be said that he was a war hero. To him, the real heroes were men like Jacques and the Allied soldiers who lay dead on the beaches of Normandy. Connie's old flame had kept his word, and the couple laughed together as they read about themselves and looked at a large picture of the both of them, clad in farm gear and standing next to their beloved dogs. The only mention of the war was a small piece of alliteration with which the reporter couldn't help but finish his article. It merely said, "The Adamsons love their life in Oatley, especially American-born Mr. Adamson, who says frankly that he finds farming a far cry from when he fought fearlessly for 4 years fighting for the French freedom fighters." That made them laugh even more. There was now another mouth to feed on the famous farm. The new addition was a 7-pound baby girl named Elizabeth. The arrival changed their lives radically. No longer did they go out together in the cool of the early morning to the barn to release the dogs, and trips in the truck entailed only Jerry and the two wagging tails. The baby had to be taken care of, and it was something they both accepted gladly. 6 months later, she was pregnant again with what turned out to be a boy whom they named Johnny. The change in their lifestyle was the main reason Jerry took on a hired hand. The new worker's name was Bill Lovick, and when he showed up at the farm one day looking for work, Jerry hired him on the spot. He was a good worker, but he kept to himself, which didn't worry Jerry too much because he liked the private seclusion of his own lifestyle with his family. Bill Lovick did, however, open up when it came to one subject, the war, but those conversations were one-sided. They were more Bill giving his opinion rather than the two of them discussing anything. The man seemed to have some sort of resentment towards Winston Churchill, which wasn't unheard of. Some were jealous of his political success, and Jerry had merely written off Bill's attitude as everyone to his own. About a week after the new worker was hired, they received a call from the Adamsons' accountant in Texas. It wasn't unusual to get mail from the States, but it was uncommon to get a long-distance call. Jerry's mother often wrote and told him what was going on in his native country, and her letters were always positive and informative. But Connie watched his face turn pale as he listened to the Texas drawl on the other end of the line. The man gently explained that he had some very sad news. Mrs. Adamson had been tragically killed in a head-on collision with a cattle truck when she was returning from Dallas during the evening. After surveying the scene and finding no skid marks, the police came to the conclusion that she had gone to sleep at the wheel of her pickup. The other driver had been treated at the hospital and released. Vance, the accountant, insisted that there was no need to return to the U.S. and that he would arrange the funeral and send him details on the farm's financial status. Chapter 12. Heat of the Naked Flames.
What is this mystery of Christ? Have you discovered it yet? Thank God I did, when I was a young man.
Jerry was sitting wide-eyed in the von Ludendorff house in Poland. Mr. von Ludendorff's eyes looked directly at him as he inquired again.
What is the mystery of Christ? Do you know?
Jerry felt as though he could hardly breathe. Fear gripped him as he sat in the room staring at an orange glow behind the preacher's head. Fire! The Nazis were setting the house on fire! The confusion was added to by the sound of a barking dog. He still couldn't breathe and began to cough violently. Mr. von Ludendorff stood among the confusion and yelled,
Awake, thou that sleepest! Awake from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light!
The barking of the dog became louder and louder. Suddenly, Jerry awoke from the dream, coughing in his smoke-filled bedroom. The house was on fire. Connie lay unconscious next to him. He pulled her from the bed onto the floor. Many times during the war he had crawled through smoke-filled rooms, and he knew that the air would be trapped close to the floor. Elizabeth and Johnny, they lay in their beds in the next room. He reached up and felt the door. It was cold, so he quickly opened it. Their room was also full of smoke. He held his breath, stood to his feet, grabbed the children, and crawled back to his wife. As he did so, he could hear the incessant barking of one of the dogs. The sound of the barking had aroused a neighbor who called the local voluntary fire department. As Jerry pulled his wife and children out into the fresh air in front of the house, he could feel the heat of the naked flames as they leapt through the kitchen window behind him. He rolled his wife onto her back, put her limp arms under her head, and began to press firmly on her back. Suddenly, she coughed. Jerry whispered, Thank God, and turned his attention to the tiny bundle of humanity lying in the dirt beside him. Johnny was fine, but by the light from the flames, he could see that Elizabeth had stopped breathing and turned quite blue. In a panic, he grabbed her body, turned her over, and with both hands pressed her tiny back again and again, saying as he did, Please, God, please, let her live. Oh, God, don't let this one die. I will do anything you want, please. He kept pressing for what seemed an eternity, but it was no use. Her little body was not responding. He picked her up and with trembling hands held her close to his chest and began to weep. Suddenly, he felt strange. It was as though someone had touched him on his shoulder. He looked around, then down at Connie. She was still lying unconscious, but breathing normally. It was bizarre. No one was there. His baby lay lifeless in his arms, yet the fear had left, and there was that same unmistakable peace that he felt the time he entered the von Ludendorff home in Poland. Then, Jerry heard a most wonderful sound. A tiny, gagging noise came from his child. Tears poured from his eyes. This time, for a different reason. He squeezed his little girl tightly in his arms, looked to the heavens, and whispered, Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Chapter 13. Not in the United States. The Adamsons moved to their neighbor's home at their invitation and took their dogs with them. The night of the fire, Faithful had chewed through his rope when he saw the flames coming from the house, then stood right outside the bedroom window and barked his sweet little canine heart out. The house was in ruins, but the family was intact, and that was all that mattered to them. The local police investigated the fire and found that it had been deliberately set. No surprise to Jerry. When their hired help disappeared the night of the fire, it didn't take Sherlock Holmes to put two and two together. Jerry didn't have much confidence in the Oatley Police Department. It wasn't exactly Scotland Yard. The typical crime in the area was a stolen bicycle, and even that didn't happen too often. That's why it amazed him to see Chief Inspector Simmons arrive and hear him explain that Bill Lovick wasn't who he said he was. His real name was Wilhelm Schmidt, a German citizen who came with his parents to Britain in 1936. The parents returned to Germany in 1939 at the outbreak of the war, and the father had joined the SS. They left their teenage son in Britain as an informant, thinking that because he was young, he wouldn't be a suspect and could be useful to the cause of the party. The inspector said,
"The man is a Nazi through and through. He's very bitter that Hitler's dream fizzed. He hates Jews, blacks, and anyone who stood against the Nazis. We've been trying to track him for years, but he keeps slipping through our fingers, and then he shows up in areas of the country and sets fire to different things. He must have seen the article about you in the paper. In the past, it has been church and government buildings, but we will get him soon."
He then turned to Jerry and said,
"By the way, Mr. Adamson's
apprehension was very rich." Chapter 14. Who is Luciano? The year was 1962. As he sat in the living room of his plush Texas home, Jerry flicked through the Roy City newspaper and casually glanced over the music section. A new group with what was being called a Mercy Beat was finding big success back in Liverpool, England. Jerry wasn't at all interested in modern music, but anything in U.S. newspapers about Great Britain always caught his interest. He smiled at the thought of Liverpool. Many times he and Connie had driven there and sat in the cold wooden stands with a warm coffee and an even warmer crowd and cheered on their favorite soccer team. He put the paper on his lap and mused about the taste of English fish and chips with salt and vinegar. He grinned that just the thought of them made his mouth water. Then he continued reading the item. According to the article, the new group, which had the name The Beatles, had been rejected by Decca, a major British recording studio. They bluntly stated, "We don't like their sound. Groups of guitars are on their way out." Jerry glanced across to the other page and mumbled, "Well, they should know." On the opposite page, he saw another item that immediately caught his attention. His hands began to shake as he read the piece. It was headed, "Israel hangs Eichmann for death camp acts," and read, "Inside a fog-enshrouded Israeli prison, a noose was placed around the neck of Adolf Eichmann just before midnight tonight. His last appeal for mercy had been rejected. Eichmann's ankles and knees were tied. He said a few last words, and then a black trap door sprang open in the floor. Eichmann, the man who sent millions of Jews to their deaths in Nazi concentration camps, was dead."
"Long live Germany. Long live Argentina," Eichmann said before he was executed.
Argentina was the country where he hid until he was kidnapped by Israeli security agents.
"I had to obey the rules of war and my flag. I am ready,"
were the mass murderer's final words. In denying Eichmann's appeal for mercy, the Israeli Supreme Court said he had shown no repentance for his crimes, which it was said he had committed with genuine joy and enthusiasm. The justices also called the death sentence inadequate compared to the millions of deaths in the most diverse ways he had inflicted on his victims. By the time Jerry had read the article, beads of sweat had formed on his brow, and his jaw was clenched tight. He looked at the knuckles of both of his hands. They were drained of blood. In his mind, he tried to imagine Eichmann's eyes bulging with terror as he hung by the rope. It sickened him that the mass murderer's pain was so short-lived. He wanted desperately to believe that there was a God and a burning hell that awaited him and every other Nazi that ever breathed this earth's air into his evil lungs. He remembered the limited feeling of satisfaction after he so closely followed the Nuremberg trials back in 1946 that resulted in 9 of Hitler's henchmen swinging from the end of a rope. It was almost an anticlimax when they were hung. It didn't stop the pain of losing his father and sister or the countless friends who died fighting the Nazis. Today's newspaper item only stirred the demons of hatred, bitterness, and anger within him. All he wanted to do was forget the past, but the past would not forget him. Every memory brought with it other recollections that carried unbearable pain. Vance was right. Oil had made Jerry very rich. Money dripped from the fingers of the Adamson family. Everything Jerry touched turned to gold. What's more, everyone liked him. And why shouldn't they? He became a giver of gifts. Big gifts. Cars, boats, and money. Lots of money. He was also liked by the Royce City authorities because he was very philanthropic. Generosity was middle name. Oil made him millions, but he had shrewdly transferred his wealth into stocks and shares, which had greatly multiplied his fortune. He was a risk-taker in war and a risk-taker in peace, and his risk-taking had paid huge dividends. Jeremiah P. Adamson was no longer the simple living farmer he had been in England. Money does strange things to people. And over the years, affluence changed him into a man of the world, a man who had ignored Shakespeare's warning to flee ambition, for by such sin fell the angels. Amidst the sea of wealth, Connie and Jerry had drifted apart and virtually lived 2 separate lives in their own home. Jerry's life was devoted to business, and Connie's life was devoted to Elizabeth and Johnny, their son. Although his name was a household word in the district, the public wasn't aware that many of his business dealings had created adversaries. The business world is often a hard, steep climb, and often one has to tread on fingers to get there. After death threats started, bodyguards followed Jerry almost everywhere he went. There were also more than a few large and shady financial dealings with people that the police had been investigating, but the investigations never came too close to Jeremiah P. Adamson, thanks to friends in high places. Jerry appeared to be a warm and generous man, but beneath the exterior of benevolence, money had surfaced another side to him that only those who were closest to him saw. His war experiences and his business dealings made him into a ruthless businessman. He degenerated to a point where he only gave gifts because it created friends that would do whatever he wanted. Money gave him power over people, and power gave him pleasure. Little did anyone but his accountant know that he had another dirty little secret. Years previously, he had invested all his wealth into a very high-yielding overseas fund that had crashed overnight, sending him wildly into debt. But late one night, he and Vance met with some overseas bankers and secured a massive loan against casino properties he owned in Las Vegas. The casinos were not paying their way, and day by day, Jerry was sinking into a giant whirlpool of debt. Once a month, he would secretly meet with his creditors and plead for an extension of his loans, each time assuring them that things would come right with the casinos.
At one of these meetings, his creditors advised him that they wanted to balance their books and that he had the month to meet interest payments. If he was unable to do so, they would take radical steps to secure their investment. After that meeting, Jerry took steps to secure more credit through the local banks, but each time was turned down, something he was not used to. This added more fuel to his simmering of anger. His call to his accountant was pointed with expletives.
"Vance, I don't care what you have to do, but get me some credit somewhere."
With his veins bulging in his neck, he screamed,
"I don't care how much interest you have to pay or where you have to get it, but get it now."
Click. In a last-ditch effort, he secured a huge loan from a foreign bank and embarked on a $2 million television advertising blitz to promote his casinos. He also made public the fact that he had low-risk, high-yielding bonds and vast quantities of revenue poured in from trusting investors. But instead of investing the money into bonds, he secretly used it to pay for advertisements, thinking he would pay it back when they roused the casinos from their slumber. They didn't. Much to his horror, the economy suddenly went sour, and people held on to their dollars with a tight fist, sucking him even further and further into his mammoth whirlpool of debt. To try and keep his head above water, he mortgaged everything he still owned outside of his business, his home, his massive yacht, and one of his two luxury cars, to yield liquid cash to stay with the extravagant lifestyle he so loved. He wouldn't face reality. He was living in a dream world of credit, thinking that somehow he would never have to pay. The sale of his assets, along with a very large short-term and high-interest loan Vance secured through a private corporation in Florida, eased the pressure from his creditors. However, in time, the stress began to take its toll on Jerry. This once happy man became deeply depressed and began drinking copious amounts of alcohol just to make it through each day. His liabilities began to weigh heavy upon his back, and life became burdensome. His dream world turned into a nightmare. The parties, the admirers, the compliments didn't do for him what they once did. It was evident to his close friends that something was drastically wrong. His creditors' phone calls became frequent and heated. His fast lane had become a dead end. One evening, there was a knock at the door. Instead of opening it, Jerry sat in the living room chair with a drink in his hand and hoped they, whoever they were, would go away. Suddenly, there was a loud crash as the door was smashed in. Three well-dressed men stood directly in front of quickly sobered up and wide-eyed Jerry. The spokesman said calmly,
"You should have opened the door, Jerry. My boss won't be too pleased to hear that we had to break down the door just to speak to you."
He then smiled and said, "We had hoped this would be a pleasant visit."
"Who are you and what do you want?" snapped Jerry.
The man smiled again, inhaled his cigarette and said,
"My name isn't important. My boss is Mr. Luciano, a name you are evidently not familiar with."
"You should be. You owe him a great deal of money. We hear through the grapevine that you are in a hole financially." The man reached up and picked a photo off the shelf, took his burning cigarette, and stubbed it into the face of Elizabeth, his beloved daughter. His smile disappeared as he said,
"My boss doesn't like to hear that people who owe him money can't pay up. It would be sad if something happened to your kid. You have 1 week to settle things with Mr. Luciano. I understand your accountant knows how to contact him."
At that time, the three men left, leaving Jerry stunned. He picked up the phone, called Vance, and said,
"Who the blazes is this guy Luciano?"
Vance was quiet for a moment, then he said,
I didn't know until this afternoon. I'm so sorry, Jerry. When I got you that corporation loan, I thought they were legit. Luciano is a cousin of Lucky Luciano, who back in 1936 was sent to prison for 25 years for running a $12 million a year prostitution ring in New York City. I had no idea that this guy in Florida was a bigwig in the mafia.
Chapter 15, Glimmer of Light. The visit from the mob thugs scared Jerry. It brought back fears reminiscent of Nazi Germany. For 3 days, he soaked himself in alcohol from the time he got up until the time he went to bed. As he pondered his dilemma, he began to contemplate the unthinkable. Suicide. On the morning of the fourth day, there was a knock of a different sort at his door. It was the law, with a warrant for his arrest. His overseas creditors had begun the proceedings they warned him about. This once rich, happy, proud, and seemingly generous benefactor was about to be arrested and, with much publicity, dragged to prison like a common criminal. As the dark figures of two law officers stood in his doorway, Jerry desperately searched his mind for someone in his past that may be able to help him. The banks had pulled tight their purse strings, and he now owned nothing of material value with which he could negotiate. The situation was utterly hopeless. His heart sunk into even deeper despondency. What was happening didn't seem real to him. Suddenly, he remembered a man named Theodore Lawson who lived near the property where he first struck oil. This neighbor was exceptionally wealthy, but the two had become hostile enemies, mainly because he frowned on Jerry's infidelity. One night when the two families gathered for an evening meal, Jerry had greatly insulted Grace, Theodore's wife, by making an unwanted and drunken advance towards her. This had caused terrible ill feelings between them because she was a delicate and virtuous woman. When Theodore confronted him, Jerry told him in no uncertain terms that his life was none of his business and it had him physically thrown off his property. The two had been at enmity ever since. But Jerry knew that Theodore was a religious man, and there was a chance he would forgive him for what he had done and lend him the money he needed to get the law off his back and rescue him out of his terrible nightmare. In the light of the way he had treated him, it would be very humbling to ask, but it was his last and only hope. He obtained permission from the officers to make one call. Then he slowly lifted the phone and dialed the number. When Grace answered the phone, Jerry nervously said, "May I please speak to your husband?" She immediately recognized his voice and warmly answered,
"Jerry, why don't you come in person and see us? Theo has often spoken of you. He has closely followed everything you have been doing."
Jerry couldn't believe that Grace remembered him and that her husband had actually shown an interest in what he had been doing. He put the phone down, walked over to the law officers, and pleaded that they allow him to visit his old neighbor. When he explained that there was a chance that he could raise some of the money to pay his creditors, they looked at each other and one said that they would escort him, explaining that if he made one wrong move, he would find himself in deep trouble. He sat quietly in the back of the police car, grateful that the law had at least allowed him to follow this last glimmer of light down the very straight and narrow road to Theodore Lawson's house. After he knocked on the large door, it opened to reveal Grace in all her innocent beauty. She looked deeply into Jerry's weary eyes, reached out compassionately, and took him by his hand. It was as though she knew what he had come for. Then she gently took him into Theodore's study. As Jerry entered the lavish room, he felt overwhelmingly wretched. The last time they had looked at each other had been when Jerry cursed him to his face. Theodore sat at a large oak desk. His clear eyes seemed to look right into Jerry's heart, but it wasn't a look of condescension, but one of warm welcome. All Jerry could think of was the way he had insulted and ridiculed this truly good man. Theodore had always done business with the utmost integrity, something Jerry had scorned. As he sat down in front of the desk, he could hardly lift his head. He took a deep breath and said, "I have come for your help." When he had confessed what he had done and that he was greatly in debt, Theodore asked for the exact amount of liability he had incurred, including the loan from the Mafia. The total was in excess of $7 million, but if Theodore could lend him even half of that, it would give him some respite. Without hesitation, Theodore called for Grace, gave her a key, and quietly spoke into her ear. A few moments later, she appeared holding a check. Jerry noticed that her hand was trembling as she gave it to him. He whispered, "Thank you," then glanced at the amount. He couldn't believe what he saw. The check was for the entire amount of the debt. He didn't expect them to lend him the full amount. He had an idea what these people were worth and knew that this check represented their entire fortune. This was so undeserved. He felt so humbled, so grateful. The loan would mean that he wouldn't be publicly humiliated and thrown into prison. It would mean that the Mafia would leave him alone, and that he could stand up once again and look his friends in the eye. That suicide was no longer an option. He looked into the eyes of the man he once despised and thought of as his enemy and said, "You had every right not to lend me this money." Theodore smiled and slowly said, "It's not a loan. It's a gift." The officers of the law knew his credit was good. They smiled at what they had just witnessed and quickly left. Chapter 16. I Need a Favor. The sight was momentous. More than 200,000 people, peaceful people, filled Washington to demand the passage of civil rights legislation. It was an evening in August 1963, and Jerry watched his television as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King spoke to the great throng which stood before him with inspiring conviction. After the news that night, the only words that remained in Jerry's mind were, "I have a dream." His mind flashed back to Oatley the night of the fire so long ago, to the dream that he had had that was so vivid. He had often thought about it, and the consequences had he not woken up. Suddenly, his thoughts were broken by the sound of a car pulling up the driveway. A few minutes later, the key turned in the door, and Johnny entered the living room. He was warm and friendly, somewhat different from the last time the two had exchanged words. As Johnny reached his teenage years, the relationship between him and his father changed. It was as though the dad he always looked up to had suddenly become uncool. Then his mother became concerned about the type of company he was keeping and asked Jerry if he could somehow mention it to the boy. Much to his sorrow, the conversation escalated into a full-blown argument, at the height of which Johnny contested, "What about you and your friends during the war? Some of them weren't the best of company, and while we are on the subject, I'm sick and tired of hearing you talk about back then." By now, he was yelling at his father. As he walked toward the door, he turned and spat out, "The days of glory are gone, Dad. All you have from them are some faded medals. I'm getting out of here before I end up an old man with nothing but faded memories." With that, he walked out and slammed the door. Jerry knew he was right about the medals. There was a strange irony about the war. He contended that he hated it, but at the same time missed the glory of living for a just cause. The medals given to him by the French government were faded, and the days of glory had over the years become a pale memory. 2 days later, Johnny called and told his mom that he had an apartment in Dallas. Now, more than 3 months later, he had shown up at home as though everything was just fine.
Did you see the news tonight? The protest at Washington? Incredible, huh?
Jerry put the argument out of his mind, rubbed his forehead, then his eyes, yawned, and said, "Something big is stirring in the nation. That man, King, is a born leader. Reminds me of a man I knew in the war..." He stopped himself from finishing the sentence. Johnny walked into the kitchen, helped himself to a Coke, prized the cap off the bottle, and called back,
"Yeah, Dad, I need to ask you a favor."
Jerry smiled, and as Johnny entered the room, he said, "How much do you want?" He shook his head and said,
"I don't want money. I've been concerned lately about the violence in Dallas. I think I need a gun."
Jerry was suddenly no longer tired. He tried not to betray his surprise and calmly said, "What do you want a gun for?" Now, this was material begging for another blow-up between the two of them. It seemed odd to him that his son entered the room talking about a peaceful protest in Washington, and in the next breath, he said he wanted a gun. As the young man sat in front of him, sipping his Coke, Jerry said, "Are you in trouble?" Johnny looked directly at him and said,
"Dad, I don't want to clash with you on this. I need a gun for protection. I'm not in trouble, and I'm not going to do anything illegal. But I feel defenseless when I'm in Dallas at night. You know what it's been like recently with the increase in violence. You have the shotgun. How about letting me borrow Granddad's .38? I promise I'll take care of it."
He had grown up with guns, and he knew how to handle them, so without another word, Jerry went to his room and came back with his father's .38 and a box of bullets, handed them to his son, and said, "I know you will look after this." He took it from his father, placed it on the table in front of him, and said,
"Thanks. I knew you would understand."
Johnny did need the gun. Not only was his apartment in an area of town that often erupted in violence, but he regularly frequented a nightclub that had a few rough visitors. He didn't want any of them to make unwanted visits, and the gun gave him a sense of security. The nightclub was actually a strip joint, but Johnny maintained that he went there more to meet people. Good conversation, he said. Furthermore, the apartment was convenient in that it was only 2 miles from the newspaper where he worked. It also meant that he and his girlfriend Darlene could be alone. Darlene worked at the club, and she wasn't the sort of girl one would want to take home to meet Mom and Dad. She also introduced him to a whole new world, the world of drugs. At first, he refused to have anything to do with them. But one day she seduced him into trying a new psychedelic drug called LSD. A week earlier, he watched her for 3 hours on a trip and listened to her rave about its mind-opening qualities. When she showed him a newspaper cutting of a number of respected doctors actually recommending it for therapy, he succumbed. She had also introduced him to Jack, the owner of the nightclub. He was a quiet man, about 5 feet 6 inches tall, originally a hustler from Chicago who liked to wear his black banded hat everywhere he went. It wasn't long before Johnny found himself taking more and more LSD, and during that time there was a subtle change in his personality. It was truly a mind-altering drug. It turned a bright outward personality inward. He also found himself in direct contact with drug dealers who sold more than acid. They were forever encouraging him to try smack, the ultimate rush. Johnny vowed that he had too much self-respect to put a needle into his body. But as time passed, the drug changed him even more. He found that without it, life was dull. So dull it became depressing. It didn't occur to him that his depression was being caused by the drug. Rather, He saw it as the cure. It was during one of his times of despondency that he decided to go down to the club during the day rather than to go to work. The door was partly opened, so he walked in to find a man he knew who talked with a lisp. It was because of his lisp that his friends called him Lips. Lips was a pusher who, by the way he dressed, was obviously successful in his profession. When he saw Johnny open the door, he stood to his feet and said,
"Hey, Johnny. Good to see you. What are you doing here at this time of day?"
Johnny managed a smile and said, "I got sick of work. It's boring. Besides, my cash is a little low and I can't afford any acid." Lip smiled warmly and said,
"Hey, man, what are you doing on that junk anyway? I told you. You gotta give Smack a chance. It's the ultimate buzz. I'm not lying to you."
Johnny didn't say a thing. He just sat there and listened to the salesman do his thing.
"I'll tell you what. I'll give you thumb at no cost."
He reached into his jacket pocket, pulled out a small folded piece of white paper and an outfit wrapped in plastic, put it on the table, and walked off. Chapter 17. Risk-Free Territory. A month had passed since Johnny put the first shot of heroin into his arm. In 1 month, he had been fired from his job and secured another one, selling heroin. After his buzz, he found his friend Lips and spent every penny he had on smack, then raised money for the next week's supply by making another visit to his dad. He borrowed $500 to fix his car. Then, when that ran out, he became involved in something he never thought he would stoop to: theft. He picked up his grandfather's short-barreled .38 and drove to a suburb of Dallas. It was late at night. No one was around as he peered into a liquor store. He sat in the parking lot for over an hour watching an Oriental man undo packets and stack cigarettes and other things onto the shelves. At one stage, there were no customers for more than 40 minutes. Johnny decided that he would wait until midnight, then rob the store. His hands were shaking as he checked the gun to make sure it was loaded. He moved the safety catch, opened the car door, got out, and cased the area. Not a soul in sight. He tucked the gun into his belt and partly zipped up his jacket. Even though he felt terrified at what he was about to do, there was a sense of excitement, both in the robbery itself and in the fact that by morning he would have enough smack in his hands to last him a month. As he quietly pushed open the door, the man behind the counter greeted him, then carried on stacking his shelves. Johnny nodded and walked to the back of the store as though he was looking for something special. Minutes later, he burst towards the terrified man. Holding the .38 in both hands, he yelled,
"I don't want to hurt you. I need money now. Give me everything you have in the cash register, and I promise you won't be harmed."
The frightened man moved quickly and gave him everything in the cash register, then put his trembling hands in the air. Johnny then said,
"If you move from here, I'll have to come back and shoot you."
Then he ran towards the door. As he pushed it open, he stopped and turned towards the paralyzed man and said,
I'm sorry."
He felt physically sick as he drove home, partly because he was beginning to withdraw from the heroin, and partly because he couldn't get that image of the man's terrified eyes out of his mind. When he arrived at his apartment, he pulled the wad of bills from his pocket and counted them. His heart sank as he totaled the cash and found that they were all $1 bills with an occasional five, two tens, and a 20. Everything he had gone through that night yielded a mere $86. The next day, Johnny sold his new car for about a tenth of what it was worth. When that money was gone, he stole a car from a parking lot 3 blocks from his apartment and sold it the same night to someone at the club. When Lips found out that he had hot-wired an auto, he advised him on ways to raise some cash without so much risk. He told him that it was far easier and less perilous to unload electrical goods through the nightclub rather than stealing a car. He said that one of the best times he found to lift goods was on Sunday mornings. He smiled as he said,
"Every second house is empty because people are at church."
When he needed cash for his habit, he would carry a bunch of fake circulars in his hand and go door to door. It was easy to check if anyone was home. He said that many religious people didn't even bother to lock their doors, so he would just go right on in and take cash and things that were small enough to hide under his jacket. But Lips had a better suggestion for Johnny. He could work for him, selling smack. He said that it was real easy, and the money was good enough to support his habit and give him a very comfortable life. What's more, he would trust him with credit with the first shipment and give him his own risk-free territory. Johnny could take over the college district, where there were no worries about undercover narcotic agents. He assured Johnny that it was an easy market. All he had to do was befriend some prospective buyers by showing them a little porn, gain their trust, then give them their first hit free, and they will be back for more. He laughed and said,
"It's so good to be able to have that sort of confidence in your product."
2 weeks later, Darlene walked up to Johnny as he sat at the club. She would normally have crept up behind him and rubbed his shoulders or stroked his hair, but this night she simply called him to a corner table. He sat down opposite her and said,
"What's wrong? I haven't seen you for 3 weeks."
She frowned and said,
"I need $600 quickly. I'm pregnant. If I don't get rid of this, Jack will fire me."
Johnny was taken back, as it was the last thing he expected to hear. Also, he didn't like her "if I don't get rid of this" attitude. As far as he was concerned, this was a potential child she was speaking about, and there was no way he was going to pay for an abortion. He reached out, put his hands on hers, and said,
"Darlene, I really care about you, and I care about our child."
Darlene winced as though he had just slapped her face, and at the same time pulled her hands from under his. Her voice became a little louder.
"Don't be stupid. I told you Jack won't like this."
Johnny lifted his voice and said,
"I will not change my mind. Abortion is murder."
Darlene didn't say a word. She just rose from the table and walked away. Later that night, when Johnny returned to his apartment, the door was unlocked. Darlene was the only other person with the key, so he hoped that she had changed her mind about the abortion and was waiting for him inside. She wasn't there. Neither was the new stereo he had lined up for sale the following day. He rushed to his room and opened the drawer where she knew he kept his cash. The $40 he had left there was gone. So was his $38. In the drawer, he read a scribbled note. All it said was, "You owe me." The next day, Johnny woke up wishing he hadn't. Not only did he feel nauseated, but he felt frustrated. Frustrated that Darlene was going to kill his child, and there was nothing he could do about it. He pulled the covers back, sat on the edge of his bed, and stared at the calendar on the wall. It was November 22, 1963. He had written on it that today was the day he had to collect $200 from one of his dealers and give half of it to Lips. But he could hardly gather the enthusiasm to do anything. Even though he had slept in his clothes and didn't need to dress, he rolled back into bed and went back to sleep. Around 11, he woke up and picked up a notebook he kept by his bed. In it were a few addresses and about a dozen depressing poems he had written about life. One was penned a few days earlier, after a deal fell through and he began to withdraw. It was called "Heroin," and the poem seemed to flow from his pen as he wrote it. Just after noon, he got out of bed, walked into his living room, and turned on a huge old television that was obviously too heavy for Darlene to steal. Then he walked into the kitchen to make some strong black coffee. He never finished making that drink. From the kitchen, he heard words that sent shivers down his spine.
"President Kennedy has been shot. I repeat, the President of the United States has been shot.
Johnny rushed into the room, hoping it was some sort of sick joke, and sat on an old couch in front of the TV. A man stood with a microphone directly in front of Parkland Hospital and said,
"Just after noon, shots were fired at the President's motorcade as it drove through the streets of Dallas."
The man stopped speaking for a moment and looked slightly to one side. He began again,
"I have just been... I have just been informed that President John F. Kennedy has been pronounced dead. He was killed today, just after noon, by an assassin's bullet. It happened as he was being driven through Dallas to the sound of cheering crowds. Suddenly, shots rang out and stunned the masses as the 46-year-old president crumpled in the seat of an open limousine. We have also been informed that Governor John B. Conley Jr. of Texas, who was riding in the same car as the Kennedys, was severely wounded in the chest, ribs, and arm."
Johnny sat glued to the TV for the rest of the day as the media kept the public informed about the assassination. Sometime later, they reported that police arrested Lee Harvey Oswald and charged him with the murder. The happenings of that day dazed Johnny. He didn't eat, he didn't drink, neither did he give any thought to his heroin habit. That night, he walked slowly to the bathroom and looked into the mirror. The assassination had also had a sobering effect on him, confronting him with the transient nature of his life. Thoughts that never entered his mind began to flood him. That one moment a man was smiling and waving at crowds, and the next moment he was dead. It was then that he remembered what he had once heard, that life is just a dash between two dates on a headstone. He stared into the mirror at his unshaven face. He was 18 years old, yet he looked like an old man. His cheeks were sunken in because of lack of good nutrition. His eyes were red with dark lines under them. He whispered, "What am I doing with my life?" Deep in thought, he walked back to his room and picked up his still open notebook from the bed and began to read the poem he had written only days before. But as he read it, it was as though he could hear a sinister voice speak to him through it. The voice said,
"Behold, my friend, I am heroin, known by all as destroyer of men. From whence I came, no one knows, a far-off land where the poppy grows. I came to this country without getting caught, and since that day I've been hunted and sought. Whole nations have gathered to plot my destruction. They call me the breeder of crime and corruption. More potent than whiskey, more deadly than wine. Yes, I am the scourge of all mankind. My little white grains are nothing but waste. I'm soft and fluffy, but bitter to taste. I'm white, I'm brown, but deadly to use. For once you're addicted, I really abuse. I'm known in China, Iraq, and Iran. I'm welcome in Turkey, and I've been to Japan. In cellophane bags I make my way to men in office and children at play, from heads of state to lowest bum, from richest estate to lowest slum. I take a rich man and make him poor, take a maiden and make her a whore. Make a beautiful woman forget her looks, and make the student forget his books. I can make you steal, borrow, and beg, then search for a vein in your arm or your leg. I'm known to the selfish and those filled with greed, all faceless regardless of religion or creed. My gift is illusion. My blessing is fake. Death and destruction follow in my wake. I'm the kiss of death to all who I touch. I start as a gift and remain as a crutch. My friends are many, but I'm loyal to none. I come to destroy, and my work must be done. Some think of me as merely a toy, but wise men know I maim and destroy. Run from me if you wish. I will never give chase, for sooner or later, you'll return for your taste. Once in your bloodstream, you'll think me not mean. You'll praise me a master, then nod in a dream. You've heard my warning, but will take no heed. Put your foot in the stirrup. Mount this great steed. Get right in the saddle, and hold on real well, for the white horse heroine will take you to hell.
A thin-faced but clean-shaven young man stood at the open door of his parents' house a little north of Royce City. This time he didn't just walk in. Johnny looked at both his mom, who was standing by the door, and his father, who was looking over his shoulder as he held a newspaper in his hands. He looked directly at his father and said,
"Dad, I would like to come home, if you will have me."
Jerry stood to his feet, embraced him, something he hadn't done for years, and said, "Welcome home, son." Johnny poured his heart out to his parents. He confessed that he had stolen, taken drugs, that he had been a fool to waste his life as he did. Then he turned to his father and said,
"Dad, more than anything else, I feel bad that Granddad's gun was stolen. I know how much it meant to you."
Jerry smiled. "Son, that gun means nothing to me compared to you. An old friend told me what you were doing to yourself, and I thought we had lost you. I don't care what you've done. You're still alive, and that's all that matters." The next evening, Johnny's mouth dropped open as he sat in the living room. Once again, he couldn't believe what he had just seen on television. Lee Harvey Oswald, the man accused of assassinating the president, had been shot to death, and the incident was caught on film by a newsman. He leaned forward and glared at the slow-motion replay, at the man with the gun and the black-rimmed hat, and hollered, "I know that man! That's Jack Ruby!" As the anchorman came back on the scene, he gave details on how the Dallas strip club owner had walked down a ramp with 50 reporters and shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald as he was being transported by police to a bulletproof van. Then he said,
"Ruby used a snub-nosed gun which fired a .38 caliber bullet and pierced Oswald's left side."
Johnny turned to his father and said,
"Dad, I think I've just found Granddad's gun."
Chapter 18. Educated Man. The money from Theodore Lawson put Jerry back on his feet. Over the next few years, the economy loosened, the casinos picked up, and life for Jeremiah P. Adamson became sweet once more. His relationship with Connie even improved a little, but he never confided in her of the depth of financial trouble he had gotten himself into, nor did she ever find out about the mob's little visit. Still, even with what they had been through, the marriage lacked the closeness it once had. That was one of the reasons Jerry found it easier to travel on business trips. Back in Oatley, he hated leaving Connie even to go into town for half a day. But now the trips gave him more of a chance to appreciate life and meet other people, especially women. One night, after returning from a business trip to Vegas, he had a nightmare that began with him and his father running out of the back door as Nazis fired shots at them. This time, however, instead of running ahead when his father was shot, he stopped and lifted him up. Then he found himself once again in the von Ludendorff's home, with the penetrating eyes of the preacher staring at him. Again, he kept hearing the question,
"Do you know the mystery of Christ?"
Then he glared at Jerry and said,
"Adulterers will not inherit the kingdom of God."
He tried to hide behind the person in front of him, but the preacher stepped to one side and pointed directly at him and said again,
"Adulterers, God will judge."
Jerry stood to his feet and cried out, "No, I'm sorry." But the preacher took no notice. He began to weep and say, "No, please, I'm sorry for what I've done." Just then, he heard a soothing English voice say,
"It's okay, you're only having a nightmare."
He sat up in bed, looked at Connie, then looked around him as though he didn't believe her. Sweat was dripping from his brow and his bedclothes were soaking wet. He looked down at his hands that were shaking even though he was wide awake. He could feel his heart pounding in his chest and his breathing labored as if he had just run up some steep stairs. Connie stared at the fear in his face and said,
"That must have been some nightmare."
Jerry looked straight ahead and said, "I don't know what's happening to me. I've had dreams about the war before, but they've never been like this." He turned to face Connie and, with the expression of a small child, explained what had so vividly happened in the dream. The next night, he dreamed again that he was at the Bible study. This time, the preacher said,
"Murderers will not inherit the kingdom of God."
Jerry stood to his feet and said, "I am not a murderer. I have only killed in war." But the preacher looked at him with a piercing gaze and said,
"God knows how many people you killed than you could have let them go. He saw how many you slaughtered merely because they were Germans. You hated them. You are no different than the Nazis."
Again he wakened, dripping with sweat. And again Connie soothed his fears and held his hand until the fear had passed. It was in those times he felt a glimmer of the love he had had for her in the early days of their marriage. The dreams did bring the couple much closer, to a point where Jerry confessed that he had in the past been unfaithful to her and vowed that he would stay true from that time onward. Not long after the nightmares eased off, Connie returned from the doctor looking quite pale. Earlier in the week, she had discovered a lump in her left breast and went to the local hospital to have it checked out. Suddenly, he was the one holding her hand as she told him the lump was malignant. As gently as the doctor could, he informed her that she had 6 months at the outside to live. Jerry held her in his arms, and they both wept. From that day on, Connie began to read a Bible that someone had given her, and it wasn't long until she was regularly going to church. After a few weeks, Jerry decided to go with her, just for moral support. It was an old, cold brick Methodist church building that had a warm interior. The old minister and the people showed the Adamsons nothing but love and encouragement. Despite the fact that he went to church, Jerry still leaned towards atheism, although for Connie's sake, he never mentioned it. His thought was that we create a higher power, or a god, call it what you will, in times of crisis. With cold objectivity, he thought of when his daughter had stopped breathing. In his time of weakness, he had called upon a greater power. This was a natural inclination for the human species. This was what was happening with Connie, and he hoped that her faith would help her through her pains. After the meeting, the elderly minister invited the couple home for lunch. After the meal, the women did the dishes and Jerry and the Reverend retired into the living room, something Jerry had hoped would happen. He wanted to test the man's faith without hurting Connie's feelings or seeming rude. As they sat in the soft lounge chairs, he picked up a cup of coffee, stirred it slowly and said, "Reverend, would you mind if I ask you a few questions about God and his existence? I'm an educated man, and I tend to lean quite strongly toward atheism. So I would like you to tell me why you have a belief in a creator when there is so much evidence in the other direction. Reverend Smalley smiled and said that it would be fine with him if Jerry didn't call him Reverend, but Edwin, something he far preferred. Then he said,
I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Jerry continued, I can understand why Connie suddenly wanted to come to church. Death is a very scary thing, and that's when faith comes in handy. My own father prayed when the Nazis were heading for us in Poland. I spent 4 years fighting with the French resistance, and I would be a liar if I said that I never prayed when things were tough. But that's my point. When things get difficult, we all need to look to God or the bottle or something to pull us through. I remember praying once and even being convinced that God answered my prayer, but I was backed into a corner and couldn't do anything but pray. The minister just smiled as though he was waiting for Jerry to make his point. So he continued. Then there is actual evidence against the existence of God. First, there is the ever-present issue of suffering. If a God of love existed, he wouldn't allow it. What father would let his children starve to death, as we have seen happen in China in years past? Or what father would let his child suffer with cancer when he could easily cure him, as in the case of Connie? Second, what proof is there for his existence anyway? You can't hear him, see him, touch him, taste him, or smell him. All I ever hear when it comes to God is, you've got to have faith. Well, I'm sorry, Reverend Edwin. I don't want faith. I want good, hard, concrete evidence. Jerry sipped his coffee, then put his cup to one side, shuffled a little in his seat, and said, I must say I feel a little embarrassed. I am a guest in your house, and I'm sorry if I have shaken your faith. To his surprise, Edwin didn't look one bit shaken. In fact, the man smiled and said,
I had exactly the same sentiments for years. If I gave you a book, would you take the time to read it and get back to me with your thoughts? It's about atheists. It's called God Doesn't Believe in Atheists. If you take the...
Jerry lifted up his hand before he could finish his sentence and said, I really don't think it will help. The minister smiled in that he had uncovered the fact that Jerry wasn't asking questions at all, but merely airing his beliefs. He said,
So you're pretty sure of your facts?
Jerry was quick to respond, Sure. To be quite honest, I haven't begun to bring out all the other evidence to support atheism. Evolution, the hypocrisy in the church, science, and 101 other things. Reverend Smalley just said,
May I ask you just one question?
Why not? Go ahead. The minister began his question with,
Look at my house. You see the windows, the door frames, the interior paneling, the wallpaper, electrical wiring, tiles on the roof, etc. If I asked you if there was a builder, what would you say to me?
Jerry's face revealed that he thought the question to be absurd, and his tone carried a slight impatience as he said, The building exists, therefore there must be a builder. Edwin said,
But I can't see him, or hear him, touch, taste, or smell him. What actual proof is there that he exists?
Jerry shuffled in his seat and quietly said, The building.
What then did you think of my mental capacity if I told you there's no evidence that there's a builder? What would you think of my intellect if I said to you that I really believe that this house, with all the concrete, nails, glass, door frames, paneling, etc., happened by pure chance, by accident?
Suddenly, it seemed like a light switched on in Jerry's head. He thought for a moment and said, I would think you were a fool. Chapter 19. The Number 40. The 2-minute illustration about the fact a building was proof that there was a builder, even though he wasn't visible at the time, devastated a lifetime of Jerry's philosophy. He couldn't argue with the simple fact that everything made had a maker. There wasn't a thing on the face of the earth that he could say didn't have some sort of maker, whether it was his car, his TV, his shoes, his belt, his telephone, his couch, or his house. All around him were flowers, birds, trees, thousands of different animals, things infinitely more complex than anything man had made. He felt stupid that he had thought himself to be intellectual in his atheistic beliefs. A short time after that, at the insistence of his dying wife, he asked Jesus Christ to be his Lord and Savior, and began to attend church each Sunday until the time of Connie's death. It was 3 months since his wife's passing. Once again, Jerry sat in Edwin's home, but this time it was in the minister's study. The walls of the small room were covered with books, hundreds of books about God and the Bible. After a little small talk about such an impressive collection, Jerry said, "Edwin, I know I can be open with you. Since Connie died, well, even though I made a decision some time ago, I seem to have lost faith in God. In fact, I haven't prayed in weeks. I feel bitter that he let her die. I wouldn't have bothered to come back and see you except for the fact that last night I had a dream that I have had a number of times since the war. In it, a minister keeps pointing to me, out of all the people in the room, and accusing me of different things. I'm confused as to what I'm supposed to do. One thing I do know, I can't go on as before, living in blind faith as though everything was all right. Not only that, I'm not sure of the Bible. Connie would read it all the time." Edwin had a gentle firmness in his voice as he said,
Being a Christian is not a matter of blind faith. The world thinks that that is what's required, but it's not true. Seeing as you mentioned it, let's look at the Bible for a moment and see if you can be sure of its authenticity. It was written over a period of 3,000 years by as many as 50 different authors, from kings to fishermen, and yet there's incredible consistency throughout the whole of Scripture. Take, for instance, how God said of the Jews in Deuteronomy that if they obeyed him and kept his law, they would have his blessings of long life, health, prosperity. However, they disobeyed him and became godless, giving themselves idolatry, which would lead to all types of sexual sin, greed, corruption, etc. He would allow them to be delivered into the hands of their enemies so that they would be humbled and seek him once again. Now, this happened time and time again throughout the Old Testament, and has continued to happen right up until this present day. One interesting consistency is that the number 40 is God's number of deliverance. The Old Testament and the New Testament harmonize in this. In fact, in chapter 7 of the book of Acts, Stephen mentions that God delivered Moses from Egypt when he is 40 years old. Then he waited 40 years before he used him to deliver Israel from Egypt. He also says that the Jews were in the wilderness for 40 years before God delivered them into the land of Canaan. Now this is unwavering, right throughout Scripture, attesting to the fact that only God could have inspired such unerring consistency. And it's only one example of literally hundreds of perfect harmonies of numerical symmetry. That alone should convince an honest skeptic to at least set aside his doubts for a moment.
He stopped his mini-sermon for a moment and smiled at the thought of an honest skeptic, then said,
"There are also many infallible prophecies which have been perfectly fulfilled, such as the Jews getting back Jerusalem back in 1967, something God had promised thousands of years previous. But there is something else you need to hear."
Jerry sat up in his seat and said, "I don't doubt God's existence. What bothers me is the fact that I keep having this dream telling me that I need to repent. I don't get it. I'm not really a bad person." The old minister leaned forward in his chair a little and said,
"Jerry, you've been candid with me, so I trust you'll let me be direct with you. Let me ask you a question. Have you obeyed the Ten Commandments?
Jerry smiled and said, No, I've broken one or two. But who hasn't? What I'm more concerned with is the fact that God allowed my wife to get cancer, then he let her die. Edwin seemed to ignore that remark. He said,
Well, let's look at God's law for a moment and see how you do. Have you ever told a lie?
Jerry smiled and said, Who hasn't?
What does that make you?
Asked the good minister. A sinner, I guess. The next statement made him shuffle in his seat.
Yes, but more specifically, a liar. Have you ever stolen something, even if it's small?
Jerry said he had.
What does that make you?
A thief, came the answer. The Reverend then looked at the Bible he had opened on his lap and read,
You have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery in his heart.
He looked directly at Jerry with the same piercing look that Mr. von Ludendorff gave him in his nightmares and asked,
Have you ever done that?
Jerry tried to hide the fact that his mouth was dry and his heart was pounding in his chest. He rubbed his chin self-consciously and said, Yes, once or twice. The minister then looked even more intently at him and said,
Jerry, by your own admission, you are a lying, thieving, adulterer at heart, and you have to face God on Judgment Day. And we've only looked at three of the Ten Commandments. There are another seven you have to answer to about greed, hatred, murder, honoring your parents, giving to God what is rightly His in the area of worship, etc. If God was to judge you by the standard of His law, do you think you'd be innocent or guilty?
He didn't hesitate to answer. Guilty.
Well, do you think you'd go to heaven or to hell?
The answer was quick and positive. Heaven.
Why? Because you think God is good and will overlook your sins?
Jerry nodded in agreement with such a thought.
If a rapist and murderer expects a judge to overlook his crimes because he thinks that the judge is a good man, he will probably hear him answer such a presumption with, You are right about one thing. I am a good man, and it is because of my goodness that I am going to see that you are punished and that you are brought to justice. Now, those who are hoping that God's goodness will overlook their sins will find that the very thing they are trusting in to save them will be the thing that will condemn them and send them to hell.
Edwin then closed his Bible as if to say, I rest my case. He stood to his feet and walked around his desk as if to close the conversation. Jerry felt like saying, Don't leave me like this. But he, too, rose to his feet, and as they walked toward the door, he asked the minister, What do you think I should do? As they stood at the doorway, he said,
Jerry, you know the gospel, that Christ died to save us. You know that he took the punishment for our sins. We broke the law, he paid the fine. You need to ask God to give you understanding as to what that means, and you need to repent. Put your faith in the Savior.
And then he stopped speaking as though he had thought of some better way to illustrate what he had just said.
Jerry, it's like a man who found himself deeply in debt. Now, he was utterly without hope, and there was no way he could pay his creditors. The law was about to take its fearful course when a rich friend extended grace toward him and paid his debt in full. It was actually the law that drove him to grace. If the law hadn't pressured him, he wouldn't have sought help from his friend. Can you understand that?
He could, more than the minister knew.
God's wrath abides upon every person who has transgressed his commandments. If the law is allowed to take its fearful course on the day of judgment, its sentence will be eternal hell. Now, it's our knowledge of our true state, we are in big trouble, that drives us to the gospel of grace. Our salvation was no small thing. When Jesus suffered on the cross, he paid the fine with his own life's blood. Just as the friend showed that his love was more than mere lip service by paying the debt, so the cross is an evident expression of God's love and grace toward you and me. But these are just empty words until God reveals the truth of them to you.
Then Reverend Smalley reminded Jerry of the story of the prodigal son, a story that he hadn't heard since his Sunday school days when he spent most of his time counting the patterns on the wallpaper. He refreshed his memory by telling him it was the story Jesus told about a wayward son who left his father and ended up in a pigsty. The young man then returned, penniless, and asked for his father's forgiveness. As Edwin spoke of the rebellious son, Jerry quietly thought about Johnny's experience. Then, as he was beginning to walk away, he turned around and, with a troubled expression, asked, "What should I say to God?" The reply came,
"It's like a man who has betrayed his wife's trust and committed adultery. His loving and faithful wife is more than willing to take him back, so in what attitude should he approach her? And what should he say to her?"